Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. That's how Andrew on the board. S&P Futures. Andrew, you gotta be a little vime of myself coming back. S&P Futures are up 12. NASDAQ Futures up 55 after a huge day yesterday. We're at an all-time high. We got to get a little bit of a Rita Coolidge on here maybe tomorrow. Talk about him being at an all-time high. I have to assume Kevin's at an all-time high.
Oh, no. I'm actually just kind of dragging my ass today.
Well, it's a good day for that. Did you guys get the incredible amount of rain we did yesterday?
Well, we got some, but not incredible amount.
It was pouring pretty good. I made it down to the truck without any rain as soon as I got there, and then all the way home it was absolutely pouring. I poured for probably an hour and a half when I was after during the day. It was pretty bad. No crazy wind or anything like that, but just I guess if you're good for the crops, as they say, good for the crops, eh?
Hey, you know what? I don't know what it's good for or what it's not good for, but nobody gives me a vote about whether it's going to rain or not. So.
Well, that is the truth. How would you like a vote?
I don't really worry too much about it.
Not sure I'd want to vote. We'll get too many votes. We got not enough votes.
Not even consulted them.
Imagine that. If a farmer wanted it to rain, somebody else wouldn't want it to rain. He's having a picnic. Can you imagine the politics of that?
Well, I'm sure Bill Gates is out there somewhere worrying about what he can pump into the atmosphere and control the weather. He's already working on blocking the sun so that we don't get so much heat.
Well, I thought the Canadian wildfires did a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, they did.
I haven't seen that in a while. Are they over? Are they ever over, I guess?
I haven't paid any attention because I've been kind of taking it easy this week and haven't spent too much time outside.
Well, wasn't it last Thursday, Chicago had the worst air of any city in the world? You got to be number one at something.
You know, if they were only the 51st state, we could probably take care of this.
Yeah, it's unreal, huh? But the interesting stuff going on with the CPI number coming out yesterday, and I don't think a whole lot of people. I don't know. It's so funny, Kevin, how the numbers get so like politicized. And the only thing I will say, because of my long experience, unfortunately, is that the whatever's happening. Whatever's tariff, whatever it is, whatever's coming, there's going to be a delay. There always is in the CPI. Now, I guess if you didn't work with it for 40 years like I have, maybe you just don't know that. But I don't know why, but there's always a delay. I mean, if the tariffs are going to give, and I don't see how they don't raise prices some, because they have to. Now, how much, who the hell knows? Every single product is its own.
It's product by product, yep.
And, but, it's not going to be the $660 billion that the administration said. Where is it? 3-4, someplace in there. It is what it is. It is what it's going to be, let's put it that way. And I don't see how, by September, October, we'll figure this out, assuming we have a straight CPI, which we probably haven't had in a long time either. So, at the end of the day, people know they're getting nailed, and I think people know that inflation is picking up right now. It has for a few months now, which isn't a surprise because they're pumping money into the system. The what's going on in the stock market, great day for clients, great day for us. I mean, it was, Kevin, it's, I mean, I don't know, this is not necessarily a shameless plug, but I've been through a lot of this. I was standing there in 87, it was not a good day. 89, better day, it was a mini crash. So I've seen this stuff happen, and I have never seen, even in the dot-bomb era, I've never seen stocks valued like this. We're just money for nothing and the chicks for free. And I think it's incumbent upon anybody, not necessarily, I mean, everybody's got, you know, they're locked into their stocks. They listen to the drivel of the idiots all day long. These stocks got a lot of room to go. They got a lot of room to go. And you know what? They might. But at some point, yesterday I swore I wasn't going to do this anymore. But all these guys are doing about how Palantir is, you got to buy it. Look, it's been up $40. It's, you know, blah, blah, blah. Kevin, the stocks this morning, it's up $1.78. Imagine that up again. It's trading $188.75. Take a guess what the revenue is per share.
About 10% of that.
You see, now you're acting like a Midwesterner. Try $1.50.
Yeah.
And the revenue, some idiot, and I use that term, was gushing about how they beat earnings. They were only supposed to be 20 cents. They were 30 cents. Kevin, the stock's trading 188. 30 cents is a land office win? What are we talking about? All right. Who knows? Palantir could be sitting on a gold mine. Stock could be worth 300. I don't know that. But I look at Microsoft. Never seen a stock that big. Price like this, both revenue and earnings. Nvidia, same way. Meta, not so bad, actually. Not as bad. Apple's up how many billion dollars? I will say this, categorically, and you can take it to the bank, they can't all quadruple in the next year. One or two can. Some of them are maybe too big to do that. They can't all do it. The only way you can do it, and this, Kevin, is reminding me so much, I wasn't around, but I'm going to start doing some more research on the start of the fiasco in the Weimar Republic. This is starting to look just like that. Money is just all over the place for some people. It's pouring into the system, and it's three or four countries in the world are doing it. Somehow, some way, we're enriching some group I don't know what a year from now. I can't even imagine if they actually get the hell's number, 10% money supply growth. I mean, it's hard to even understand, Kevin. I mean, Apple is up, I'm going to say $20 in the last week and a half because they cut the deal with the Donald. Okay, so they got some deal. They're going to get. They're not going to have to pay the tariffs other people are going to take. Now, how the hell?
Yeah, the way their deal is structured is they're supposed to put $600 million of investment into U.S. production. And when I heard Trump interviewed about it, or he was doing his press conference on it or whatever, he said, we're still running the meter on them. So if they don't do the $600 million,
oh, bull.
We're going to backbill them. We'll see if that happens.
Yeah.
But allegedly, that's the threat that he has to make sure that they do it.
Well,
And really, when you start to look at some of these, you know, commitments to domestic production investment, if they all come to happen, and we know they're not all going to do it. It's good, you know, some are going to fall by the wayside. Some are not going to just, you know, are going to be half the. Whatever, but if they all do, then we're going to see a pretty substantial a reshaping of the domestic economy around that. And then what we're also seeing is that there's at least potentially, because it's in early stages, there may be a significant reshaping of how world trade works. And that's kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting because we don't know what's going to happen with any of that. This would be so different that I don't know how you go out and predict, you know, how this is going to shake out the economy.
People
could be a major disaster. Could be a good thing. Who knows?
It's all behind the mind of a couple people that were the worst students in school and have not written any economic paper on anything, any idea. I mean, it could end up. What were the big group in Sam? Was it Samsung down in Texas? Was it a couple weeks ago, Kevin? Who were we talking about that? Was it Carl? They were supposedly building this huge place, and they said there's no customers. They stopped building?
Yeah. Well, the way things have gone over the last 20 or 30 years might be a good thing for all the people who didn't write papers back in the day.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I don't...
Because the people who did are the ones who've been guiding guiding the ship.
Well, the ship has some interesting stuff going on it, but this whole concept of individual deals for people, God, for God's sake, Kevin, Caesar didn't do that. A tax is 40%. Come see me; I'll make it 30 for you. I don't know. I don't know where that mentality came from, but I don't see how that.
That's totally a Trump mentality.
Well, but it's okay. It's not mine, and I don't know.
I understand, but that's his mentality, and that's how, that's partly what's behind a lot of the foreign policy successes they have. The foreign policy team has brokered deals just this year with Congo and Rwanda, Armenia, Azerbaijan, India and Pakistan's ceasefire is still holding, as is Israel and Iran for the time being.
India and Pakistan.
Egypt and Ethiopia. My point being that's all about transactional stuff and saying, how can you all do business together? Forget whether you like each other or not. What can you do to be, very transactional? What's going to be in your financial best interest? And, that's just the approach to this. It worked well in the first Trump administration with the Abraham Accords, and I think that's sort of the international model. And I think we're going to see more of that come up, too. So, again, I don't know, because that's going to reshape a lot of economic activity in the process.
Economic activity, some people are being, this is not working its way. Anyway, I know that I hope it works, but this total inflation, and I don't trust, when you have a person, and I don't know of any other, maybe there might have been presidents that did this. I don't know if J. Edgar Hoover ran his engineering firm out of the White House. He could have. I wasn't here, neither were you. When you have tax and monetary policy so driven in one direction, and if I were to name the people who are the biggest single benefactors of that policy, just like the farmers in Germany who got to pay off their mortgages as money tripled in a week, Trump is in the business of owning the Doral, owning these places, and nothing benefits him more than lower interest rates and more inflation, because he gets to pay off the mortgage way faster than he ever dreamed he would. And
you know what? If we back up the train 20 years, that's true of everybody, because we know all of Trump's investments and businesses and all of that kind of stuff, and we know he benefits from it. But how many people in Congress, how many people of influence in administrations? Because we've seen, how rich people get when they get involved in government.
I don't recall.
And I think it's I think we're seeing the same thing.
Did Obama own 5 golf courses? I don't think so.
How much money is Obama worth now?
He wrote books. He did those kinds of things.
How many $100 million did he make off of those books?
You can't even put these two on the same planet when it comes to grifting for themselves. Writing a book. I can't wait for this guy to write. Hey, when are we going to get a new manager for the Cubs? Maybe that put me in a...
That's a gear shift.
Maybe that's what got me in such a grumpy mood watching those idiots last night.
Oh, God. Remember we talked last weekend. They had that one big breakout game on Saturday, and I said, don't trust it. But that's just one game. It's not a trend. And it's not the start. It's not necessarily the start of anything. And they went right back into the strikeout kings.
They all of a sudden became they're a defensive speed team. And when they act like that and just get when home runs happen, they're pretty darn good. And all of a sudden, they're becoming a station-to-station swing for defense team. And I don't see how any of these guys are. You know, to not pinch hit for that Armstrong guy with the bags a little last night is the dumbest manager in the league I've ever seen. The guy went up and swung at four balls that he couldn't have reached with a pine tree. I mean,
they did pinch hit for him in a game a couple of days ago, which was an eyebrow raiser at the time.
Well, it's not. How could it possibly be an eyebrow raiser? The guy can't find his ass with both hands, for God's sake, up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, he doesn't even belong in AAA at the plate. Or what am I? And the other guy,
Pete Crow Baez.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what genius move was to take him from a speed spot, like either down on the lineup, which is pretty much a speed spot if you're batting eighth or ninth, or make the move and put him up in the top spot. How your three fastest guys are Horner, Pete Crow, and the shortstop, and they're not up. Why is the first baseman leading off, Kevin? Because
he gets on base.
Well,
speed is great at the top of the order. Speed is great in the leadoff position, but not if he's not getting on base.
Well, but you put Armstrong in the cleanup spot when there's people on base.
Yeah, well, he's a little farther down now, but yeah, not much.
And all he does is he wanted a grand slam last night. You know, and that's then the other night, he finally gets a duck snort hit, steals second, and gets picked off. What is the purpose of that? The kid can walk to third. He could be start standing on the base. Why is he that far off? What's the matter with him? Has he become uncoachable?
Don't know.
I mean, right now, what are they, seven games back? Yeah,
they keep saying on the broadcast that he's getting his pitches, he's just not hitting them. Well, I don't care.
Bull. Last night, there wasn't one of them. There couldn't have been a strike in that at bat, was there? I didn't see one.
Yeah, if he wants to swing at all that outside stuff, he's got to take it to the opposite field.
Well, I just wonder, I mean, Kevin, when we try and both of us coming maybe from different directions, but as you look around, you see the incredible inflation in the amount of these teams are worth. You see, you know, the Bears somehow are planning on, which is, I think, is all BS, but they're planning on moving ahead with Arlington. They're going to break ground if they get the right tax stuff. And now the governor says, well, maybe we can relook at helping the Bears out. Kevin, where in this world right now, but all the crap we've got and the stuff Trump's trying to do, the stuff the mayors are trying to do, the governors are trying to do, there's a massive lack of resources. And we're worried about helping somebody who's making a family that's making $200 million a year. What planet are we on?
Unfortunately.
I was having a beer with a bunch of beer knotheads the other night. And they're talking about, yeah, they're gonna do Arlington Park. I said, guys, I'm not interested in doing a back of the envelope calculation on building stadiums today. Let me ask you one simple question: who built the last two stadiums? I don't know. Well, try L.A. and New York. Okay, the stadiums cost something like $4 billion. Isn't that about the number, Kevin? 3.5, 4, somewhere in there. And this was 5 years ago, 6 years ago. We've had pretty incredible inflation since then. And what do those two stadiums have in common? Oh, I don't know. What you should know, your football fans, both of them have two teams in them, not one. Oh, yeah. Well, so if the math barely works for two teams, and now the number's up to probably $5 billion, how's it going to work for one? Who's going to pay for this? I don't know. It's a good question. I don't even know the numbers, Kevin. I don't know how much it's going to. You know, but I'm saying, how can that possibly work? If something was $5 billion, and somehow, if you don't get money from us, even if you get a 6% loan, which you're probably not going to get, it's $300 million a year to write the check. That's one hell of a lot of concerts, right?
Well, it's a lot of concerts. What they have to do, they have to monetize that whole property at Arlington Park and find a way to make it all pay. So, if I've been to Phoenix. I've been to State Farm Stadium still in Phoenix. There is a whole entertainment district that is busy every day right around there. So, you know, it's kind of built around the stadium being there out in Glendale. But it's, you know, and I don't know without this, I can't say with or without the stadium that it would thrive nearly as much. But I think with the stadium there, it does thrive. And that's really what they have to do. That's the same thing we've talked about Dallas and the Mavericks.
Dallas doesn't have that.
Pardon?
Dallas doesn't have that.
But that's what Cuban's side of the equation is. That's why he sold the team part of it, so that they could build out the entertainment district around there.
Well, I mean, we already have entertainment districts. I'm saying,
I know what I'm saying.
But I look at the most successful, probably, stadium there is. And is the one in Dallas. And what happened there is a guy who's much more capable than the ownership here, in my opinion. I don't know if I like him that much, but he's very, very capable. Their deal was they thought they were going to build a place for $650 million. So he came up with $3.25 million. And the city used it as an opportunity. They've got this amusement park down there. I don't think it's as big as Great America, but it looked pretty nice. And around there, they had all these, I use the term scrub areas, trailer parks, you know, that kind of stuff. And they had the Texas Ranger Stadium, the older one now, which is beautiful. And they said, okay, we'll come up with the $325 million, the area. I don't know if the state helped or not. They probably did, but they essentially condemned and cleaned that whole area out, which they wanted to do anyway, because evidently it was too close to it. You know, they wanted. I think the new baseball stadium is there too, right, Kevin? It's close to there. Plus, I think it is. I'm not positive. And so they put that dough in there. So they started at the 650. But Jerry Jones, as it went on, he wanted to put upgrades to it, and he kept putting more and more money in. And the place is spectacular in terms of. Just in terms of engineering and in terms of those kinds of, some of the stuff I don't like, actually, but you know, if you don't walk in your gate, you can't get to your seat. There's no way to walk around the stadium in the stadium.
And that's in Arlington, right?
Yeah, it's right near where the old it's a quarter mile from the old Texas, the old maybe it's four parking lots away from the old Texas Ranger Stadium. Because I went down there and I stayed in a hotel there.
The reason I bring it up, because I haven't been to Dallas in, I don't know, but the reason I bring it up at all is because that was like out in the middle of nowhere. It wasn't Fort Worth and it wasn't Dallas.
Right, either. Oh yeah.
So, you know, if you are going to build a reason for anybody to be there, the only reason to be there is for the sports stadiums. Now, that may not be true anymore. They may have had all kinds of industry sprawl out that way and all kinds of housing, and so that may be completely different now. But it's sort of like, you know, when you go back and you look at Phoenix and you look at Glendale, you know, this is on the west, you know, the very far on the west part of Glendale, so it's a little bit of a haul to get out there, but it's all sprawled out there.
How do you know it works? I
don't know it works. Yeah. I just know it's busy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, be brief on my story, Jerry Jones kept putting money in a place, and the engineering of it is something like I've never seen. When you see outside, you see these things, these arches that are into the ground. It looks like a bridge. They essentially built a bridge, Kevin, with these big arches, almost like, you know, if you go to North Avenue or some of the bridges now, the big arch over the river. And all the stuff, the scoreboard and everything, even part of the roof, hangs from the middle. So that thing supports a lot of the weight. They have something to the effect of 300 and some skyboxes of something. They're not all skyboxes, but if you see. But anyway, the money part of it is Jerry kept dribbling money into the thing to the point where literally, I don't know about the women, but if you go to the men's room, there's a monitor. They got more TV. Any place anybody could possibly be, basically, including the can, the guy put a monitor in. There's more monitors in that place than anywhere else in the world. And he was the first.
Because you don't want people to miss a play for the game, and you don't want to have any reason to discourage them from using the bathroom.
And he's got the big hole area where the thing goes down. It's not just, I mean, the roof in Arizona, the baseball stadium, you don't even, if you're in a stand, you don't even know the roof's open. It's this tiny little thing up top, and it's like a hole. But now this one, the ends come down, there's a breeze in there. As a matter of fact, the scoreboard has wires hooked into the seats, so that if the wind comes in there too good, it won't start swaying in the wind too much. The scoreboard in this place cost more than the entire old stadium. What was the old stadium with the hole in the roof? That was the name of that place. Anyway.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
But through really intelligent type of stuff, downstairs is like a highway. That's where they bring all the food. Because we were there, I did a tour on a Monday. It was Monday Night Football. You should have seen, they have all these incredible, well, not incredible, but these, what I see in the truck docks, Kevin, the big wire cages that are all locked, going to different areas and different skyboxes, all full of beer and everything. You wouldn't believe the amount of rolls, the amount of hot dogs, the amount of beer that was there. But the only place you can get around is underneath. And that's where Jerry gets to drive in. Whenever you see people, they drive in down there and they head for the locker rooms down there. But the point is, through incredible amount of his own time and forethought, the entire tab of the place, I think, is about $1.3 billion. And he makes that work at $1.3 billion with $320 coming from the place, or the area. And when I was there, they were taking up, you know, that artificial surface with all the ground-up tires in it that everybody uses now, pretty much?
Yeah, field turf.
Well, they must have been having a demolition derby that night, so they're taking the field turf up. So they got these forklift trucks that are massive, and they pull a big swab of the stuff. Now, I don't know how it links together or hooks together, but each swab is probably, well, the forklift truck goes maybe 20 feet in the air, and there's the hunk of field is on each side of it, so it's wrapped over like a carpet. Then they got some machine that comes over and beats the bejesus out of it to knock all the rubber out. And every like 10 feet, there's a pile of rubber, maybe 8 feet high. There's an amazing amount of rubber in the field. And when they pull that up and beat the crap out of the thing and shake it out of there, you sit there and go, my God, they're going to put this thing down again and spread all that crap out again? And evidently they do. But the guy's got, you know, all kinds of stuff going. Because like you said, if there's a demolition derby, there's a kind of, they do wrestling. But I mean, we're talking, you know, 25% of the cost, and way better management.
And they're good at promoting too, because they hold, you know, major college, you know, opening weekend of college football, they always have a major game with big name teams. That, you know, and they do, you know, they get involved in all the bowl games, all the, you know, playoff games and all that. They're very good at promoting. And yeah, I think, you know, we'll see what Kevin Warren's influence on this winds up being. This is like the second time in my lifetime that they've given the keys to somebody outside of the McCaskey family to run the show. And we'll see if he's better at it than anybody else was. But definitely the McCaskey family was. I would have no faith in them to pull this off.
Well, they've run. You look at history, and you know, my mother used to say, "Leopards don't change their spots." They've never owned anything, ever. They leased at Soldier at Wrigley Field for what, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. And they've leased here. The most they've ever paid in rent is $6.5 million. Now you tell me that if she was still alive, that lady would write a $300 million interest check to start the year and hope to catch up. I think she would have died much sooner if she had to write that check. I mean, we're not even on the same planet. And now, and the city here, and the thing that, you know, as you know, Kevin, I love the city. I see what's happening to it. I'm appalled at what's happening to it. I don't think it's, you know, argumentatively one side or the other. The cities are just the epicenter of every bad thing that's happened to the economy and the programs in the last 40 years or 50 years. I really believe that. They're just the epicenter where all bad stuff comes together. And by the way, if you went to Western West Virginia or some of these other areas or Arkansas and you looked around or Mississippi, you'd see the same thing, just nobody looks and nobody cares. You know, it's a, if you're out of sight, out of mind. And there needs to be some, you know, some way to address it. And I don't know what the way is, but I know one, the way that it isn't is fighting about it. Oh, God, it's all the Democrats. Oh, God, it's all the Republicans. That doesn't get anybody anywhere, in my opinion. It's time to sit down and say, okay, what are we dealing with here? Because I think that what we're dealing with is way worse than most people think. I honestly do. And, the idea that, you know, the Democrats are gonna do something, some program. Well, yeah, come on. We've tried every damn program. And Trump, he's mad at the homeless. Go find a home. Well, fine, Donald. Act like an idiot.
That is not what he said in D.C., in the D.C. press conference 2 days ago.
Okay, I'm looking at...
not even close to what he said.
It doesn't matter what he said. It matters what the headlines say and what people believe. That's the point.
It doesn't matter what he said. He said, we have places you can go where we can get you help. He was, you know, that was specific. So if the headlines are saying something different, the headlines are should be ashamed of themselves. Don't repeat that shit because it's not true.
The one...
I'm a big fan of just let's be truthful, and you know I know that that out of the Trump administration we get a lot of our fair share of BS, more than our fair share of BS too, but geez, when let's not put words in their mouth that they didn't say.
The message that I hear from people is the one that you're always.
I don't care what you cited Donald Trump as saying that.
Kevin, if I were this morning, if somebody, this is the one disagreement that you and I have, and it's not a personality thing. It's not a, we're gonna hate each other because of it. What I talked about this morning, I'm talking about, you should go home and look at your stuff, and look at your stocks. Ask yourself, would I buy them today at this price if I look at the numbers? I guarantee you, somebody somewhere, in his mind is gonna say, this chief guy said sell all stocks. In his mind, that's what I said. Now, I was very careful to not say that. But
And you know what, Tom? I am not going to go misquote you.
No, you won't. But my point is that the stuff about there's a subliminal part of what Trump and his people say. They know what people are going to pick up. They know there's a massive difference between what somebody like you, who actually likes to listen to somebody like a regular person, which I'm calling you, and I'm going to compliment you now. You're not careful. Sit down. Like a regular person, you have the dignity and the intelligence to actually go say what somebody said. Kevin, you're 1% of the population like that. The rest of the people pick up on the meme. They get it summarized from somebody else, and all of a sudden, there's this hunk of BS there that maybe the person who said it in the first place knew that's what really was going to get out there. I mean, I'm just saying that's what happens. I'm not defending it. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying you're wrong from actually listening to somebody. You're the one who's right. I'm just saying, here's what the message is. I mean, what by the time it goes from person,
I get that, but that doesn't mean that it should be repeated. Certainly not on this show.
Okay, I saw two headlines yesterday.
Let's not repeat what others heard.
I can't repeat a CNBC headline.
When you see a headline and it sounds crazy, it's always worth going and looking into it.
Somebody.
My number one rule is I see all these headlines and I say, oh, well, that is that really, you know, did somebody really say that? And then I go look and find out that, you know, it's like the fine people BS.
What if I, for instance, knew that as much as I couch my terms, people are going to get this message. As much as I dot the I's and cross the T's in case, you know, FINRA's listening to me, I'm clever enough that if I want to get that message out there, I can. I have a feeling that this administration is doing some of that. Is my opinion, and you may disagree, but I think they know where it's going to land. They know who they're dealing with, and they know it's going to be picked up to a certain extent.
Yeah. So you're a dog whistle theorist.
No. I mean, okay. I'm just saying.
That's okay. But this is why I tell you you're not in the middle, because that's the common Democratic talking point. So.
No, I tell you what, I'm perfectly capable of saying the same thing about the Democrats. I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if my life depended on it. I mean, I think she was a crook. When she had trades going into her account, which I never wanted, I said I can't vote for her if she's dog catcher. Everybody has their limit on somebody. She reached mine with that. Plus, I didn't like the fact that she was getting foreign money in a foreign foundation when you're not supposed to get foreign money for a candidacy. I wouldn't vote for her, life dependent on it, because she had warts all over as far as I'm concerned. And she wasn't the personality I wanted in this position. Okay, now why can't I say the same thing about Trump? I feel the same way about him.
You are welcome to say the same thing about him.
But I'm not. When I say that, if you're in the middle, you look at both sides and you're appalled.
I encourage you not to put words in his mouth that he didn't say. You don't like it when people do that. I really hate it when that happens. And I react pretty strongly to it all the time when that happens. So all I'm saying is just,
Kevin, the part we're missing is it, or that we're disagreeing on, it's a fine art to have people pick stuff up that you really want to say but don't. It's a fine art. And I think these guys are good at it. I know I could do it if I wanted to, but I don't. I could say stuff about the market that, somebody from FINRA would sit there and read the script and say, he didn't say anything wrong. Yet I know exactly how people are picking it up. I'm just saying it can be done.
Yes, and also it can be, there's a fine art of how we report things and how we edit news clips and things like that. Remember the big controversy over Trump using the word bloodbath when he was talking about the auto industry, not some kind of visceral reaction to him losing an election. And of course, everybody stopped the clip at the word bloodbath, and with those words in his mouth, and that's, this is not. First of all, it's unethical for reporters to do that, but it's the kind of thing that just boils my blood, because you'll get enough out of Trump that you'll find outrageous. You don't need that.
Did his people call CNBC and say that's not what I said? I doubt it.
Yeah, everybody did.
He didn't say that he warned.
There was a lot of counter.
I'm talking about warning the homeless. I'm saying, Kevin, it's a fine art. What do they used to call it? What was the term? Who was the guy in? Goebbels was supposedly so good at it? The misinformation or whatever. People are good at this stuff. I could have a whole routine tomorrow on how. Where anybody listening to the show would say. Chief says buy or chief says sell, and I can tell you I never use that term anywhere in the thing. I say, what are you talking about? I never said that. Yet I know exactly where it's landing. People have a way of communicating, and whatever. But we're never gonna. I'm saying it's a fine art of saying something and having people hear something else. Sometimes you screw up and they do it, and you're really sorry they picked up the wrong message. Sometimes you planned it that way, is my only point, Kevin.
Okay. Well, I think you're reading a plan in there that doesn't exist. So.
When I have very...
Because otherwise, why would you say it that way?
Well,
you could be much less explicit about that. You could be much more vague.
Well, we're talking about somebody who continually tells the world that other people are paying these tariffs. And yesterday, he called Goldman Sachs up and told them to fire. This is what really is starting to concern me, Kevin. The article I sent, who knows where this guy got this crap, but essentially, according to the article, Goldman Sachs' chief economist came out and said tariffs are going to work their way into inflation. So I don't know if Trump or somebody called the head of Goldman Sachs and said, you need to fire this guy, because that's not true.
Yeah, well,
but the part that really was sinister, Kevin, and you're a strong reader, Evidently, the guy, whoever this economist is, has a hobby or something. We also DJs on the side.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
And all of a sudden, they said, and Trump said, make him a full-time DJ. I want to know who the bleep in that idiot's organization that went through that guy's Facebook and dug into his background so he could say something like that. I would never do that.
Actually, he's well known in Washington for being a DJ.
I wouldn't even think of something like that. And yet these guys doing it, it makes me feel real creepy about it, Kevin. It just does. They got no business talking about his other hobby. Like they know the guy, like you know where he lives. There's a subliminal message right there. We know what he does, we know where he lives, we know where he does the DJ stuff. So that's right what that message is.
Well, hopefully the guy from Goldman, the head of Goldman Sachs, told him to go scratch.
I don't know. All these guys are tied into government to such a huge extent. I keep going back and forth on the economy here, and now you know we've got people now saying maybe we'll get the labor numbers only every quarter, and now we're going to do something with the CPI numbers and blah blah.
Well, yeah, there have been interesting conversations around that because they said, because they're right. I mean, a lot of the number gathering is still done by fax machines and mail, so it is a little outdated in terms of process, and we've questioned the accuracy. But the problem is, how do you shift to an accurate system and still maintain some kind of historical reference so that you know from this year to last year that, how do you do any kind of comparison? How do you do any kind of trend analysis? So I think there's a real challenge there. It's doable. There's a lot of people in data analytics who would know how to pull that off. So it's doable, but man.
It has some big flaws in both sides.
Yeah.
But the flaws are, and even, I don't think you or anybody in your classes, they have a different view of this, Kevin, than you'll see every man. I've heard people tell me, man, they're off by 200,000 people. There's a revision. I said, okay, well, the revisions come from the companies, and we're talking about 160 million people that are working. You're talking what percentage of error? It's not even, what's 1%? 1.6 million? So it's what? It's 0.1% error? I mean, in terms of that, I mean, I think we know. God, if anybody listens to the show, we go over this all the time. But I don't know of any place that has somebody as good at this as Carl, and the rest of us aren't so bad at it either. We know that there's a big problem with the difference in the household survey and the other survey, and we know doing surveys now is getting harder and harder. This is not something we don't know, Kevin, and the CPI number. Every time I criticize it, I say, I wouldn't want that job. Because we just took the one line yesterday, if we were listening, on your electric utilities. Cost of electricity. Okay, what's the cost of electricity? That would seem like a pretty simple question, wouldn't it? Duh. Well, it isn't. You get your bill, there's a bunch of taxes on there. What if taxes go up? Now, is that electricity? No, but does it hurt you? Yes. What if they keep the electrical rates even, but they raise the cost to get to your house, even though they don't put in a new line, they don't do anything. Okay, that goes from $40 a month to $50. So you don't even use any electricity. It's $50, where it used to be $10 or something. I mean, how do you count that? I mean, real stupid example, if somebody, and this is probably even in the stack, but just say that it isn't, if somebody says, okay, if you don't use your tolls, if you don't use the Easy Pass, we're going to raise the cash tolls. Even if you had cash tolls now, we're going to double them. Well, now, is that a raise in the rate, or is that a stupido tax, which we don't count? I mean, this is incredibly difficult to do if you were straight, Kevin. If you were straight, and I think we know, I mean, from the people on the show, there's two massive problems with the CPI. And it's not the people that go out and gather the price of rice or noodles. I think you can count on them. I hope you can. But it's somebody who says, for 25 years, medical cost for is 6.5% of somebody's basket. That has been there through Republicans, through Democrats. The idea that one is sinister and one is benevolent is insane. It's been wrong. One of my buddies is on Social Security Medicare, and he doesn't have any other income. And he takes Eliquis, which is the one, that's why I'm always zeroing on that drug. That, him out of pocket, Kevin, I think he makes $25,000 on Social Security. Him out of pocket on that drug is $3,500. The cost of the drug, because Medicare Part D picks up half, is $7,500. The thing's been around for 15 years, and I bet their cost per year is in $100. And now that, so what is $7,000 going to $25,000? For God's sake, Kevin, that's 20-some% of that guy's basket, one drug. And yet, what are we? We're not even on the right planet here. You know, and plus, if you go look at the other one, is a price of home ownership. Who's the genius? And I don't know. Did that start at a Republican or a Democratic administration? Either way, the next person didn't come in and say, "Well, that's bullshit. Let's change it." They've got the price of home ownership, owner's equivalent rent, which means if you didn't own the place, what would it cost for you to rent your own home? All right. Well, I did some work. That line is up from 100 to 213 since 2000. So in 25 years, they've got it up 110%. I'm going to say the price of houses is up 300%. What do you think the median house was in 2000, Kevin? 160? And now we're, what, 410? So not quite three times. I got to believe the taxes are at least tripled. And I'm going to say the homeowner's insurance is up.
Even if they just increase with proportionate to the increase in the home prices.
But I'm going to say that they're probably way more than triple.
I know, but theoretically they're tied to property values.
So. And I'm going
to
say your homeowner's insurance is up five times. So how can you put out to the people, Democrat or Republican, saying here's what your stuff is? I've argued with a whole bunch of people in my. There's always something you can say if you. To get it long enough, there's always an argument stopper, Kevin. And when it comes to the CPI, the guy who used to do escalation clauses, I mean, and by the way, I'm never getting an argument at you on this one, but if I did, I would say, what if we started O'Neill and Chief Construction 15 years ago, and we're going to build 10 houses a year for 15 years, and we gave the right price, you know, a little bit of profit for us, not a bad thing, profit's good, and we had an escalation clause in there using the CPI, would we still be in business? I don't care how much of a dummy you are, you're going to say, I don't think so. So if that's the answer, what are we doing? Has this been a 25-year, 30-year, you know, debasement of truth to your population, but that every single side of the aisle agrees with? You can't tell me they're arguing about this. I've never even heard them say anything, have you?
No, and the shame of it all is that there are some really good data scientists doing really great analytics work in the private sector, whether it's built around demand planning or all kinds of other product trends. So it's doable. There's the talent in the world to pull this together in a very rational, very accurate and predictive way. But somehow it's not finding its way into government, where it seems like for government, whether it's labor statistics, inflation statistics, or whatever, is we're doing what we do because that's the way we've always done.
I think we know the message we want to give, and we give it. And somebody yesterday, and we'll see what the PPI number today, if you look at the report, one of the things that actually it was a little worse on the X food and energy. If you look at the report, the actual price of gasoline was down 0.5%. The adjusted price was down 2.2%. And I'm going to say, wait a minute. Who does that, Kevin? Is it somebody who actually has a reason?
What's the basis for adjustments, which is why when it comes to the labor numbers, you know, as we get into it, and Carl's there every labor release that we do, that we look at the unadjusted, because the unadjusted is at least going to give you a better idea of what's trending in there. I know they're trying to smooth things out so that this month doesn't look unnecessarily bad or unnecessarily good, but I don't think the adjustments serve any purpose. I think the raw data is that should, first of all, that's the basis. And if it jumps around, if it's seasonal, so they're trying to smooth out some of the seasonal stuff. And, so if it's, don't smooth it out. You know, if it jumps around, we can compare how it jumps around year over year.
Yeah.
We can do all of that.
But that's...
We're so intent on adjusted numbers. And I have somebody I interact with every once in a while who's, you know, very vested in the stats on this, and he's an economist. And he just is appalled by the idea of using unadjusted numbers. Why would you want to do that? It's so entrenched in the mindset that we don't do it. And that's not what's happening in the private sector. They're not adjusting numbers. And that's why they're getting a lot of success for large companies, and now even moving into smaller companies who are really good at analytics.
Andrew, let me know when Larissa piles in.
She's in. Okay. She's in, so you should kick me out of here and go to your next guest.
Well, the adjustment that everybody, and by the way, Larissa's really up on this stuff, so we're going to kind of continue where we are, but the adjustment that, on the labor numbers, Kevin, way, way back in the day, I mean, when I first started looking at this stuff, which is, you know, a while ago, the big adjustment was December and January. Because, as you know, well, maybe November, December, and January, because you know how many, I don't know if, my mom never did, but a lot of people, the lady who's been on a show with us, Robin, that unfortunately died in an auto accident, she would always go to work, even though Robin had a great job, and she was traded on the trading floor. She would always go to work for 4 weeks at like Macy's or someplace, or Needless Markup or one of those joints, and so she would go there and make some dough. She knew fashion, loved the people that come buy stuff from her every year. And by the way, got her 20% discount or something. I mean, if you didn't adjust... I remember back, Kevin, this has to be 40 years ago. If you didn't adjust the December numbers by 200,000 people or 220,000 people nationwide for people who went and worked in department stores, talking about how long ago this was, the numbers were if you didn't hire 220,000 people, it was a bad year because that was the number. So an adjustment like that, I guess I can understand.
They're doing that same adjustment, even though everybody's shopping online.
Yeah, or what it is now. Kevin, thank you. Talk to you on Friday. Are the Cubs going to win a game? Are they even going to make it to the wild card? At this rate.
I don't want to talk about the Cubs. They piss me off.
All right. God. All right. Andrew, we have Larissa, how do they pronounce it? Is that Adamaic?
Adamaic.
Okay. Larissa was on before with Russell, was a great guest. Russell is flying someplace secretive on a private jet, I assume. I don't know about that. She's associate clinical professor, Purdue College, Health and Human Services. By the way, congratulations on that the new digs over there. Good for you.
Thank you. I'll say boiler up.
How do you like? Or did you move to West Lafayette?
I did move to West Lafayette, and I have to say West Lafayette has been amazing. I've had the opportunity to work with the local schools and other organizations here that have been unbelievably kind and supportive. So it's been truly, truly amazing. If you've never been to West Lafayette, the parks and the bike trails and everything, it's just stunning.
I was there once. To a football game. The Irish were playing Purdue, and it had to be, I think it was one of the first games of the season. I'm going to say it was 97 if it was anything. The seats in the stadium, I think, are black, aren't they?
I'll be candid. I have not been there yet. I'm hoping to take my kids to a football game. I've been warned that basketball tickets are almost impossible to get at this point.
Yeah. Well, Purdue's got a great team. Basketball, they used to be really good in football. They're just kind of an also ran in the Big Ten now, but they might have an Indiana moment. You don't know, Indiana came up with.
I hope so.
Yeah, but it was so hot, and one of the guys from the trading floor, who shall we say, liked to drink to excess, did a little too much drinking. We actually had a limousine in those days. My buddy and I bought a limousine for whatever stupid reason. Not a big stretch one, just a regular come off the factory floor limousine, and. We used to drive around in it. It was an absolute riot. So we actually drove.
I bet.
But, you know, actually, something you can tell your... the Cadillac, the big, huge Cadillac Fleetwood, we're talking like back in the 70s, was like a monster car. The limousine that came off the assembly line was actually the same size as the Fleetwood. It just had a bigger back seat and a smaller trunk. And that's what people would take to the coachmakers to essentially get sawed in half and extended to make the big, huge limousine. We just had the regular one, so it was basically the size of the Fleetwood with a big back seat. But can you imagine a couple of young idiots driving around that thing? How much fun we had! I mean,
I stopped in a liquor store recently, and they said this store opens at 7 a.m. on game days, and I thought, oh my! So to your buddy who likes to perhaps drink to excess, there's plenty of opportunity if you're going out to a game.
Well, I think he was in the back of the limo because I, of course, was driving, and I think we went down a whole bottle of vodka before he got there.
Gadzooks!
and of course, the limousine had a nice air conditioner. And all of a sudden, he's sitting in this 98 degree. I thought he was going to croak in the stands, but he didn't.
Oh, I bet.
anyway. So what is different in the? I know you absolutely did not burn any bridges because you loved Indiana as well. But now it's a newer opportunity. What is the difference? I mean, without even me asking, you've already answered my question. Why is it seems like the schools in Indiana, and I'll even include Notre Dame in that, have a really good, and they didn't for a while, but now they're back, have an incredible relationship with the surrounding community. And it seems like there's, I mean, the high school's back and forth and stuff. I mean, you mentioned before I even asked, what is that just habit, or people have always been like that? Or I mean, I don't know how much of that, I'm sure some of it goes on in Illinois and other places, but it seems kind of unique, is it?
Well, I'll say specifically about West Lafayette. It's if you come to the area, there's Lafayette and then West Lafayette, which is where Purdue is located. And so you've got the university, and so many people are connected and associated with the university. My neighbors are also professors. It is just one of those things. We were walking through the park and going on the bike trails, and we ran into a bunch of graduate students. It's just a very encompassing town. And then with the school district, like where my children are, there's a situation where it's professors' kids that are going to this very specific school. And I think because you have a close group, like physically close group of academics working, they're very invested in their children's well-being. And I think that's how, particularly in this area, and I could be very wrong since I am brand new to the area, but everybody I have met with and has just been spectacular. I cannot say enough good things. And I would assume that, particularly with Notre Dame, you're going to see something very similar because you've got, in where Notre Dame is, you've got St. Mary's. I think you also have another IU campus in South Bend. So you've got Indiana University, you've got St. Mary's, you've got Notre Dame. And then as a part of it, with all those professors living in that specific area, you've got the demand and the drive for those academics to make sure that their children are taken care of.
Well, when I was there, and up until maybe not that long ago, South Bend was, there was never any connection there. I mean, South Bend was a town that was a huge auto town, and the plant closed like right before I got there. Mm. Bendix, I think, is gone now too. Those were the two big employers. The town was, it was, you know, the Rust Belt city, and
sure.
And most of your building and stuff was the other way, you know, to Elkhart and those kinds of places. The University of Chicago is almost involved in the Hyde Park community, like you're talking about,
right?
When somebody says Purdue, you think of engineering school, but are they? What are their other? I mean, there's. I don't know. I'm sure they have a business school, but. What are their other strengths? I mean, it's a Big Ten school. They got strengths everywhere. Just nobody knows about them. Now, the area you're in, health and human services, when I saw that, I'm like, how big is that department? Is that, does somebody go there for a major, or what is it? How do you fit in with people's perception that it's an engineering school?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because that was one of the questions I had in my discussion with Purdue. And I'm actually within the hospitality and tourism, and that's where they have put in the consumer financial planning, the CFP program. So I will be teaching CFP classes, which is slightly different than teaching from the straight in the business program, which is the Daniels Business School, which has really blossomed. So they have their new dean, and he's been on the media. He's quite a commentator on Bloomberg quite a bit, and he's been really raising the profile for the school itself. So where I am, it is a more consumer or a client direct services, which is why it's not housed in the business school. So when you think of traditional business finance classes, you're thinking of taking straight investments, you're thinking portfolio management, derivatives, you've got your corporate finance classes. And in the CFP program, I'm teaching is an investments class, but I'm also teaching estate planning. There's a tax class. And again, these are now thinking about how a consumer sets up their portfolio. And it's interesting, and I think there's going to be a greater demand for people who can do these things and become certified CFPs with the upcoming transfer of wealth as the boomer generation now goes ahead and passes down their wealth to the next generation. So when you think of a CFP, you think of working with high net clients, but now we're going to have a boom of clients that are going to need these types of services.
What I mean, when I took economics at Notre Dame, and actually University of Chicago sort of the same way, there was a business economics major, mm-hmm. but mine was in arts and letters. So I'm assuming you're in arts and letters, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
In the social, you know, economics really is a social science. I mean,
it is. Yep.
So you is there an arts and letters economics degree at Purdue?
Well, I actually came to find this through the agriculture. So it's the economic agricultural degree, which is how I ended up finding this position.
Really?
Yeah. And if you think about Purdue, and so another, we've got the business school, we've got STEM. One of the things that Purdue's also known for is their agricultural department. It has, I think, one of the largest farm research facilities.
Don't all the original land-grant colleges, wasn't that part of the deal, that they all have an agricultural school?
I don't know that. I just know that Purdue is the top. And so that was exciting. And again, if you're thinking about from an agricultural standpoint, understanding finance is incredibly important. So you've got, you know, how do you genetically modify plants? How do you optimize growing plants? Things along those lines. But then you've also got to think from an business standpoint, how do you use financial derivatives to lock in different prices?
Are you, I know Illinois, one of the issues here, and it's, you know, one thing nice about Notre Dame is who knows if it's still like this, but when I moved over to, I started pre-med for a year, and then I went to Arts and Letters Economics, which is kind of a shift, eh? But the guy said, what do you want to do that for? I said, well, I don't want to be a doctor. Oh, okay. Well, so that was what that did. But I was able to, there was no, in Illinois here, if you don't apply to the business school, evidently it's crowded. You can't take electives there, which is
where
I was able to. I took a full year, you know, of regular accounting with the workbook, you know, debits to the window and credits to the door type of thing, and really learned the basics. I took investments, I took taxes, I took all that stuff in the business school just as electives, and I was never told I couldn't do it. So my arts and letters degree was buttressed by probably 8 or 9 business courses, or maybe not that many, but 7 or 8 for sure. I don't know. I mean, can you guys, the people there, can they easily take electives in other businesses, or are you like Illinois where you're locked out?
So in my department, you can. So we do get a lot of transfer students from other colleges that end up in our degree. But to your point about the business school, I think that's really important. So business has what's called business core classes, and you apply to the business school because your freshman year, you need to start taking freshman business classes. And your freshman business classes will traditionally, and I've seen this both in Illinois and Indiana, consist of Accounting 1, Accounting 2. You'll also take Economics 1, Economics 2, and perhaps a Introduction to Management class, as well as starting to work on some of your gen eds. So you're
What are gen eds?
Your literature classes, okay. Your history classes, the general requirements, and usually gen eds, and again, I can speak to more about this in Illinois, there's specific requirements that the state sets that you must, all of these students must have to be able to get the degree. So when you're, and this happens a lot in engineering programs. So if, for example, you are a U of I student, University of Illinois student, and you get into their engineering program, you start as a freshman and you have specific science classes that you have to take your freshman year, your sophomore year, and so on. And you combine that with different gen eds, and your program is almost weirdly locked in. It's not a traditional cohort program per se, but you're in a situation where if you miss a science class, or in business, if you miss like accounting too, well, then you're not set up to be able to take the intro finance class your fall of your sophomore year, which is when a lot of students will take that class.
So you can fall behind and tough to catch up, but you can catch up, I hope.
It's difficult to catch up without taking an extra semester or taking a summer class.
Oh, God, accounting in the summertime, I can't think of anything worse.
I know. Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, that's a challenge with the business school because they have business core. Very similar to if you're in a STEM field, that's what happens. Because, again, could you imagine if you miss physics too?
Oh, I can't.
Yeah, I mean, and then you're all of a sudden, all your other classes are built on this class. And so then you're over the summer taking it, or you're perhaps even having to take another full semester of classes. And as a result, you're kind of lockstep. Now, the program I'm in has a lot more flexibility. We don't have that lockstep. We don't have that business core program that you're encompassing all those other types of classes. When you study, I'm with the CFP program, when you're studying these classes, you're not built into a core of other classes that you are required to take that are so encompassing that you must start as a freshman.
That's weird, because at Notre Dame, there was a freshman year studies program. You had concentrates, but you could always catch up and change if you had to. If you were to change from rocks for jacks back into pre-med, I think you'd had a problem, but do you guys still call that rocks for jacks, geology freshman year?
Well, I mean, I do, but I don't know that other people do.
Andrew, did you ever hear that term, rocks for jacks?
I have, yep.
How many specific classes are you teaching?
I have a 4-4 load, but I am teaching 3 this fall.
Wow.
I'm very excited.
Are these all during the day? The reason why I ask is, the thing that set me off to accounting was I thought I might have an accounting concentrate at University of Chicago, and I'm going, well, they had a special. Now I'm going to grad school, right, and I'm commuting. They had a special where if you took 2 classes during the summer, imagine this, Larissa, I think it was $900 or something.
Oh, my goodness.
And for the 2 classes, which meant if I took 4 the next 2 quarters, I actually graduated in April, and I didn't have to pay the full amount, which was like $1,200. So I saved $400 or something. But in one of the classes, the difference between these, I use the term idiots. They were so bright in a lot of things, but they actually had the people who were taking the 190 program, which was the night school, and the people on campus. they took the same test and actually were marked on the same curve.
Oh.
Now, you can imagine, maybe you can't if you've never done it, the difference between two 75-minute classes in one 150-minute class after you worked all day.
Oh, no, I can. I used to teach this awful class, and I will say it was awful. It ran from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m.
That's what they did, yeah, with a little break. That was it. Well, it was 6:30 to 10, I think. 150 minutes, whatever it was.
And I remember this one student, she looked at me, because these are all working adults. They all, you know, several of them had kids, and she's sitting in like maybe the front row because she got there a little late, and I'm talking and you could see her start to kind of nod off, and she looked at me and she said, "You have such a melodic voice." I'm just, and I thought, "Well, this is going to be a rough semester."
Well, in the 190 program, the place wasn't air conditioned.
Oh, goodness.
Downtown. It was right near the Hancock building, right in the same block. And yeah. One of them was accounting. God, I hated it. I hate it. But the weird part is they would actually tell you on campus how everybody did on the test. And on campus, there was never anybody in a downtown class that came close to the grade I got, ever. And it wasn't like they weren't just the smarter, maybe smarter. No way could you work all day and sit in there with no air conditioning. And take accounting for 150 minutes and not come out of there and say, what am I doing with my life? I could have been in a bar or something. I mean, it was awful. But are you guys all...
I'd like to actually comment on that. So my dad took a class at in Illinois, and he was in a similar situation where there's the day section and then the night section. He's working all day. I want to say he had maybe a kid or two, which would have been me. I don't know if he had kids yet. Anyway, nobody in his class is doing nearly as well as the day class. Well, he comes to find out that the people in the day class are all talking to each other, and they're all sharing answers.
Oh, really?
And they all have extra resources because they go to the library where old exams are. But if you're a night student and the library is closed, or you don't have access to that, or you don't even know that exists.
I have to believe it. Not one person from the night class ever went to the library on campus.
Yeah, I fully believe it. And this has got to be back in the late 70s when this happened. My dad again is working full time. And he's coming, and he's doing what he can do to graduate. And if you don't know and you don't have access to those resources, it's not a level playing field.
No, God no. But it's still amazingly beneficial. I mean, do you guys have an executive program?
We do.
That was my stepfather was got to be one of the original guys in that University of Chicago. Where they'd won Friday one week and then Saturday the next for the NBA. And then Friday night they'd all grab the faculty members and they all go out and drink martinis till wee hours.
Sure.
It was a way of the faculty members keeping in touch with business too. So it actually worked out amazingly well. Let's talk about other than I could chit chat with you forever about that kind of stuff. But I'm starting to see, and I have different people on the show, first of all, nobody agrees with me, ever, usually. But you know what? If somebody agrees with you, you don't learn anything, right?
No.
And we have some issues with the labor numbers. We got some issues with the CPI, and we're putting somebody in there who evidently his job is to never give the president a bad number or whatever. Maybe I'm being a little too harsh there. But then there's... looking at the numbers by walking around and keeping your eyes open. And I sense, since I did inflation since I was, 22 at Pullman, I make that 25, I'm pretty sensitive to it. And I think inflation is coming back. They're pouring money into the system. They either don't know what they're doing or they're lying to people, something or other. And people benefit from that and other people don't. What are you seeing? I watched the Cubs lose down in St. Louis. And I see empty seats in St. Louis. I've never seen empty seats in St. Louis before. Are they pricing people out? Was it too hot? I mean, what are your little things? Because I have a feeling you have a pretty serious radar on the top of your body, not just hair. And what are you seeing? What is your radar telling you here? What are we doing?
I think people are starting to cut back a bit. Even though inflation is not rising, right? It came in lower, but I think that because the last time we spoke, we talked about sticky wages, right? So people's income isn't, and people are starting to really think about what they're going to buy. And I think people's shopping habits have shifted. So for back to school, all of a sudden we're seeing really deep discounts for clothing and other things that kids need for school. And typically, because I've been doing back to school shopping for a number of years now, typically at this point in August, most of your back to school products are going to be full price. So to get the really good sales, you start in the beginning of July. And that way, and then in August, you've got back to school, but it's not nearly as deep discount as in July. So like the early birds get the special, so to speak. And now we're finding, or at least I'm personally seeing when I go to the store, school supplies, because again, I've been buying them for several years now. The prices are cheaper now, and that's unusual. I don't usually buy a lot of back-to-school clothing. My sister does that. Her kids are roughly the same age as mine, and she's been stocking up on children's clothing because I get deep discounts. So we've got a unique situation of perhaps even a bit of over-inventory for some of these stores, which is why they're offering these deep discounts. We've also... people are being very cautious about what they're buying and how much they're buying because credit card debt is going up, and we're in a situation where people don't have excess funds to be able to spend their money on these types of things. And then with regards to the baseball game, it has been incredibly hot. I know I personally wouldn't have wanted to go.
It's been, you wonder, you see, stuff that they've done to their clientele, which I don't necessarily agree. But for instance, I like to have my own ticket. I know that makes me a Luddite, but if you've ever had season tickets, if I want to give you four tickets, I just want to give them to you. I don't want to mess with your phone. And if you have a problem getting in, I don't want a phone call at 6:30 saying I can't get in. They can say that I'm the Luddite, but I'm also the customer, and it's so much easier to just give somebody the ticket and say go, that whatever. I'm saying some of the stuff they do, I don't think anybody, there's no walk-in crowd anymore at any of these games. Some of the stuff they've done, but you wonder at the edges, what you're seeing. I like to go out a lot. I live alone, so when I go out a lot, and you go to restaurants and bars, and you think they're crowded, but unless you ask the owner, he might say, I haven't sold an over $50 bottle of wine in 3 weeks. I used to sell two a night. Or he may say, I haven't served a dessert all night. There, stuff happens around the edges, which I think you're very aware of, that maybe other people aren't aware. They just walk by and see a crowd in there and say everything's fine. Well, it may not be fine, right? I mean, or it could be really fine. I mean, how do you know? Unless you're actually the person doing the counting, right?
Right, and it's funny you should say that. My youngest son and I have a thing where we like to go out and get fries together. And one way I've cut back is we only get one set of fries. Now, we used to get two because my small child does not like to share. And before I was okay with it. I thought, he's two or three. It's reasonable. He's now four. And I thought, nope. We're going to cut back and we don't need two orders of fries. We'll only get one order of fry. But again, to your point about the fringe, it's how can I reduce the specific check? Yeah. And I think that's an important aspect. We were out to eat. I had my kids with me and we're at this restaurant called Triple X in West Lafayette, and they both wanted milkshakes because they're known for the milkshakes. And the waiter, I thought, was very kind, and he said, if you get this specific kid's menu or this specific kid's meal, the shake comes with it. You better believe my kids get that specific kid's meal.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you see it, I mean, in the amount of what families, I mean, I just thought we'd have to go to break here, but we were out, my girlfriend and I, we have our places on Saturday night. We kind of do a routine of about 8 restaurants. They all, you know, we're nice to everybody. They all like us type of thing. And so we went to one of our staples, Fox's, to get a pizza. So the lady bartender, we know for sure, she goes, well, you know, we've changed the menu. We always get, even though it's only 2 of us, we always get the family-sized pizza. So there's enough next morning for me to, because she's, I'm always up at the store at 6 o'clock and come back. And the two dogs, when they know there's pizza, all of a sudden they're right next to me. Hey, where's that pizza? Yeah. I think dogs like pizza more than anything else they eat, without a doubt. And anyway, so they go, we're cutting back from we're not going to have an 18-inch pizza, we're going to have a 16-inch pizza. So Audrey, who's, you know, she's pretty bright, she goes, why are you guys doing that? You got nothing but families in here. You're slitting your own throat. What are you doing?
Right.
And sure enough, we looked around. There was probably 5 families there, and there's normally 10. I mean, just little stuff like that. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, for families who go out to breakfast, if you got 3 kids, what's it, $100?
Oh yeah, no. I don't go out to breakfast anymore with the kids, because with me, and again, I'll get like a cup of coffee now. Like one way I've cut back is I don't eat. You're still looking at maybe $40.
Yeah.
And that's just insane.
Well, you know, it's thanks. But it's the people in the restaurant, and you know, this is weird, but I'm gonna go to break. I first heard this, and you know, you hear stuff from people. That's why I love having people on, because everybody's on gives me a nugget that I never thought of before. Well, this is years ago, that the head of White Castle, of all places, is on CNBC. And they're interviewing the guy, and this has to be just before COVID. And they said, what's the single biggest problem in the restaurant business now? And he goes, that's easy. The spread in cost between what you can eat at home and what you have to pay to go out is never been higher. Now it's got to be a lot higher now. And he goes, that's a problem because of the leases, because of the taxes, because of the electric bill. He goes, that's a big problem because people come out, and even if you try and be as lean as you can, they're going to sit there and go, God, I could have done that at home for $20. I just paid $100. You know, and at some point, if you've got, you know, if you're long the stocks that are going up, you don't care, I guess. But other people that aren't do care. I mean, and you sit there, and I can't do this 4 nights a week, or maybe I'll do 2 nights a week or something. It's, I mean, that's why we come back from break. We'll kind of keep going on this, and just, and I'll from what I see on the business side and how restaurants now even concern themselves with people coming in, it's probably something you already know, but maybe not. SP Futures up 15, NASDAQ Futures up 75. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Okay.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 15. NASDAQ futures up 75. This is on the heels of a huge rally yesterday. The CPI number came in more adjusted or more tepid than people thought, or people were worried about, probably more than what they were worried about. It shows the tariffs aren't really piling through, or at least the message is the tariffs aren't piling through, at least not yet, as to any huge extent. I think that's accurate. And by the way, I think it was to be expected. I think they're a couple of months away for whatever they're going to have. The DAX up 1/90, 0.8%, so they're up again today. FTSE up 19.2%. CAC around up 40.5%. So FTSE's kind of the dog over there, but they're still up. Over in Asia, and these guys have been hot, or at least the Nikkei's been hot. Nikkei 225 is fresh high. We're going to have to get Rita Coolidge on one of these days, running all-time high from the bond thing, right? Nikkei up 556, 1.3%. These guys are to the moon every day now, 43,274. Hang Seng up 643, 2.6%. Shanghai up 17.5%. So the sky is the limit here on virtually all this stuff, which is, you know, it's pretty good. 10-year bonds down 3 basis points, 4.26. The bond down 4 basis points, 2.70. Oil, which hasn't been able to get out of its own way, again, down 12 cents today, 63.05. So nothing there. The only hot spot in there is heating oil. As Greg told us last Monday, we've had a spike in heating oil prices vis-a-vis gasoline. Not sure why that is, but we have had. Now, gold's up $10, back up 3,400, 3,409. Silver up 66 cents, that's almost 2%, 38.66. We've got crypto, 729, 120,460. We've got foreign exchange. The dollar is down a little bit, as the euro's back over 117. Got down to almost 115. British pound is 135.7, almost 136. And again, we'll talk a little bit with Larissa, but everybody ignores this foreign exchange thing, but 1% and 2% moves in currencies is incredible, and yet nobody talks about it. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Cubs suck.
Yeah, they do a little bit. It's 7:38 here in Chicago on, August 13th. There we go. And yep, the Cubs lost against the Blue Jays 5-1. Meanwhile, we did get some wins here from the White Sox. White Sox over the Tigers 9-6. And the Diamondbacks over the Rangers 3-2. Chicago weather is not looking much better than the Cubs right now. We are currently at 71 degrees, so a little bit cooler today, but it's going to be sunny and humid. We're going to have a high of 81. That might jump back up a little bit through the rest of the week. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 90 degrees. They're going to have sunny skies and partly cloudy ones throughout the day. But they're going to have a high with a dangerous heat warning. It might be a high of around 112 today. And finally, for Chicago traffic, another not too great day. It's looking pretty heavy on both the inbound and the outbound on all the major expressways. No major accidents to report. But if you're coming in on the Kennedy to the Jane Burns, it'll take you about 45 minutes today. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
All right, we're here with Larissa Edemiak. Is that, did I get that right this time?
Yep, this is sounds good.
Okay. What three classes are you teaching? What's your favorite? And I have to assume you're popular. What's your favorite? What are you trying to teach people?
Well, I'm not popular yet.
Well, you've only been there a month.
I'm just starting.
Give yourself a break here.
My favorite class to teach is investments, and I'm excited for this particular class because it's within the CFP. I want to tell you about a project I'm going to work on or have the students do. One of the things that's really interesting, or one of the products that's really popular, is to create these structured products that CFPs will sell to their clients. And really, it's a combination of getting into some bonds, it's some derivative usage, and maybe even pairing it with the overall market. So maybe getting into a futures product. And I'm bringing this up because I'm going to have the students learn each of these financial products, and then they're going to have to package them in a way that's something sellable to a potential client. And I think it's an interesting thing because they will be selling these products to clients in the future. But if they can really understand the mechanics and how you put these things together, I think this is going to be really helpful.
Oh, yeah.
And
wow.
If they really get good at this, they can actually create their own products and they don't have to necessarily use a middleman. So we'll see if the students like it. But it'll be a new project for me to introduce, given the different dynamic of the student.
Well, that sounds great. Just for the listenership to delineate who all these creatures are. When I say creatures, if you're a broker, which we are, PTI Securities, we get paid by you doing a trade, okay? Mm-hmm. If you're an investment advisor, which we also are through Wall Street Advisors, you can give us your money, we'll invest it, we'll get limited power of attorney, and then we'll get a fee, okay? Right. We don't go into a lot of that, but we do some of that. A lot of we do subcontract work for people where they'll send us maybe their more difficult positions because I'll do them when they don't want to. That's kind of an odd spot to be in. All the rest, or a certified financial planner can actually take. They'll help you with estate planning. They'll help you. You know, they get paid by the hour, sort of like an attorney, right? And it's a delineation is how you get paid, correct?
Right.
And you can't come to me for insurance. I mean, I'll say go to somebody like Larissa because I don't do that. So I'm not your investment life coach. We're like a certified financial planner, sort of is. I mean, it's not up to me to say, give me money for stock and sell your two investment properties. I mean, I'm not going to do that. But a certified financial planner, that's essentially their job to look at your whole thing, right, Larissa?
Right, and you hit it right in the head when you said, and you're looking at insurance products, you're looking at annuities, you're looking at things that really aren't things that we're necessarily thinking about in the financial markets.
Right.
And that's, I think, an important distinction between the two. And I'm excited about this because these are not necessarily things that I personally have thought about because my background is in the financial markets. And one of the things that I want to introduce to my students is, and I say, you're going to have a client that's going to say, oh, CPI was down. What should I buy in my stock portfolio? Well, that's really not the job of a CPI or a CFP, right? And then what do you do with that client who's really gung-ho on a specific stock idea or specific the market idea? And how do you then navigate so that you're not necessarily giving up business, but at the same time, you're being appropriate with what you sell and what you do and what your services are?
When people have asked me, by the way, I've never downplayed a financial planner because I think somebody should have that. But I've always had a concern, and give me a C paper here, grade me. I never trusted products that try to do two things. It's like if you want to buy insurance, buy insurance. If you want to put your money in the market, put it in the market. Don't blend those in the same thing. Because I never could figure out what they were actually doing. Are there products now that are blended that I can trust? I mean, the idea that you can have this kind of a thing with an equity kicker. If you want an equity kicker, put it in the market. And what do you think of that? Are these blended sort of things?
So that's a great question, and I'm with you. Before this, I was very skeptical about CFPs. I was very skeptical about how do you structure these things. But I've seen people work with CFPs and have had spectacular results in their portfolios. And I think the advantage for an average American who would require the needs of a CFP is that they're not going to be somebody who's an expert in the markets, and they're not going to really be able to do specific stock selection or diversification in their own portfolio. And that's an advantage that they can use some of these products for.
That's true. I think with the index, with the advancement of these ETFs, then again, I'm going to ask you about that. Is there anything in life that, if it's good for something, it's also bad for something? It's like your first beer. Your first beer is pretty good. Your 12th one probably isn't such a good idea, right? I mean, it's
right.
I'm at opposite ends of the spectrum here. When I started the business, the Dow was like 800, so it was a while ago, and interest rates were 15%. Take something, and. As a matter of fact, we had who was on yesterday? One of the guys that was talking about options was saying that, well, now your call options used to be worth a lot more, and I didn't want to dive into that and say, well, The reason why is because your call options, a lot of what's the value in there is the interest rate, which of course nobody even has a clue on now because interest has been so low for so long, right? Because if you buy the option, you don't have to buy the stock, and if you're paying 12% for your margin or 14%, that's a big deal, right? So
very big deal.
And everything was, all the stocks that were around, they were still making money. Most of them were paying dividends of, you know, just to somehow compete. But they were absolutely flat on their ass. And it was just a matter of time. It took 18 months after I started for the rally to start. And, of course, I had hardly anything in my account. And when I pissed away most of it being long, a year and a half too soon. But now I look at the market, and it goes up every day. Everybody's euphoric. I probably have 10 people, Larissa, that I know pretty well, I've known forever, that all want to talk to me about hedging some of their portfolio or protecting themselves. Every week we go up, they put the meeting off a week. You know, it's squirrely, and yet I look every day. I don't want to sound like people should off their stuff because it goes up every day. I look at some of these valuations. I think I'm on another planet. You know, the valuations of some of these stocks are twice as high as they were in 1999.
Yeah, valuations have gotten out of hand. What
do you think of that? I mean, what is your view? I mean, I'm not asking you for be a market timer, but these stocks are so big and they're trading. Well, first, I don't know if you do this. I value a lot of stocks on the revenue per share, not income.
Okay.
Because you know, one you can. You can do a lot of capital expenditure that knocks your, well, technically it doesn't, but your income down, but you can't really cheat on the revenue, right? I'm seeing some of these stocks.
The manipulations of income can be astounding.
Yep. When you start seeing big companies, 10, 15, 20, 25 times revenue, I'm sitting there going, wow. I mean, that's way higher than they got in 2000. I mean,
right.
What do you make of it? If somebody were to ask you, not asking you to be a market timer or anything, what's your feel here? I love the market. I just wish it was half as high. Where you know, I love Microsoft. I don't know if I can't handle it at 5:30. I just can't. I mean, am I just nuts here or what?
No, because again, earlier you were talking about inflation, and we were talking about how people aren't spending as much. And it doesn't seem to align with these incredibly high valuations. How can you justify all of this revenue, and yet you're still looking at people saying, well, I'm not buying extra school supplies this year. It doesn't, to your point of, are you nuts? I think it's a nutty situation. These things don't seem to really be lining up with each other. And I think that's right now a challenge in the world. And you know, we were talking about those structured products. I love ETFs. I'm very pro ETFs. I'm negative with mutual funds. But in the mutual
funds, by the way, so am I, but I'm gonna ask you a question regarding that. Go ahead.
Okay. But in the mutual fund space, these life cycle mutual funds are what a lot of companies are, I'm not going to use the word pushing, but
why not?
Yeah, I will. You know, you're given a limited selection of mutual funds to choose from when you set up your account, and they're all life cycle funds. You're kind of stuck. And so how is a life cycle fund not like one of those structured products that we were just talking about? So because to achieve those different diversification goals and metrics, that's what they're doing in those life cycle funds. And now we're seeing them in these structured products. We're seeing them showing up or cropping up everywhere. I believe that if there aren't products, ETF products that are like that, they're going to be ETF products.
There's more ETFs than there are stocks now, aren't there?
Pardon me?
Aren't there more ETFs than there are stocks? I know there's more mutual funds than there are stocks.
I don't know if there are more ETFs than. That's a good question.
Got to be getting pretty close.
Yeah. ETFs are fun.
Yeah. Speaking of which, the our PTI, our signature product, and by the way, we have a trademark, is a protected index program. And we started that in 97, and it corresponded with the S&P, the S&P 500, despite her being like the first ETF. So for the first time, when we started managing money for people, I said, wait a minute, I'm not a stock picker. I traded 20 years in the OEX, if you remember that. And I said, I'm not going to, my strength is in options. So let's for people who don't have their own stock and don't want me to pick them, which is fine with me, let's be in the SPY and let's buy some long-term puts and sell some long short-term calls and try and give everybody a risk thing here. And it worked out fine. Well, then there came the Qs, then there became an others, all kinds of them. So picking the ETF is almost as much of the game now as managing it risk-wise. Because some are, like, well, we've got a lot of people in the XLV the last 2 years. Man, that thing hasn't, it's a healthcare. You would think it would go under the moon. It hasn't. XLE, a little bit, the oil, because oil's going nowhere. So, I mean, if you pick the wrong ETF, but my question for you is, and this kind of happened in 2000, where all of a sudden, when you start getting dominant stocks, I mean, I think NVIDIA is now 8% of the, either the S&P or the Qs. NVIDIA and Microsoft are now 15%, I think, of the Qs. Maybe even the S&P. I think the S&P. So if you're like me and somebody like you says, gee, I want this chief guy to manage some of my dough and I want to be in a protected index program, and you write me a small check for like $1 million, and you say, well, I want to be in ETFs. I'm not really, I think some of these stocks are kind of overvalued. If I put $500,000 into the Qs or the Spider, unbeknownst to you, you just put $250,000 into the stocks you're trying to stay away. So it's so a momentum thing now that 401ks, you get the sense that nothing bad isn't happening. Every Friday, no matter where a stock goes, no matter how overvalued you think it might be, every Friday, somebody, some mutual fund guy someplace, or maybe an ETF guy, 40,000 checks drop on his desk for $100, $500, whatever they are, for people's ETF or 401ks, and he's a buyer. So I wonder how much of the enthusiasm for these stocks, just like in 99, five stocks became 45% of the Qs, which was, and they all went flying down in 2000. And the Qs went from 120 to 25. Okay, it was down like 80%. I mean, at some point, is that a negative, I guess, is my question. It seems to me that it might be, but I don't know how you fix it, or if you want to fix it.
No, I think you're bringing up, and it's a question I hadn't really thought about, because if you're thinking about the valuation, and to your point about the overweighting of one stock, but like the Spiders will pick on them, and every week you're adding to it. So I think it would also be interesting to compare that number to the withdrawals. So if you don't have people retiring, so theoretically, if you're a mutual fund manager, right, you've got these mutual funds, you should be having some money come in from employees that are currently working, but then you should also start to see some withdrawals. And I would be interested to see if people are putting off retirement and they're not withdrawing as quickly, or if you are taking a lump sum and doing something else with it. I'd be curious, because we can probably, with reasonable expectations, find out how much money is really flowing in. But I think the more interesting question would be how much money is coming out.
Nobody's selling anything. You couldn't. If somebody bought NVIDIA at $20 and it's 183, you couldn't get it out of them with a crowbar.
Sure, but again, at some point, some of these retirees are going to have to start utilizing some of their money, and I'd be curious of how they're utilizing money, which I think is part of the research questions that I will hopefully start looking at now that I'm looking at the CFP, because with the certified financial planner, you're looking at how do you transition from your work, from working to retirement. And how do you make that happen? So you're maximizing or trying to minimize, pardon me, taxes, you're trying to maximize healthcare coverage, you're trying to really balance your entire portfolio. And how does that work embedded with your 401k as the money is being utilized for retirement?
Well, that's, you just kind of hit on, that's really the lion's share of what our business has been at PTI pretty much forever, is we, I don't know if we specialize or we, people just landed on us, we would get the people who were retiring and they would roll the 401ks into the IRA here. So they would get out of their 401k when they leave, because usually, at least traditionally, there weren't as many choices in there, and they would roll the 401k into an IRA here at PTI or wherever they went. So that's the procedure, what you do. And my brother knows more about this than me, but I think at some point, is it after age 70 you have to start taking withdrawals and paying taxes on them? Is it 70 or 70, somewhere in there? Because every year we have to call our guys up and say, hey, you got to take $5,000 out of here. It's your minimum withdrawal. So some of what you're talking about is sort of prescribed. You know,
right.
Some people might leave it in the 401k at the company that you came from, but it's pretty rare. And that's kind of where we get a lot of our concentration issues as well. A lot of UPS, a lot of people worked at UPS in the old days. Their 401ks were all UPS stock. So we would have concentration. Somebody dropped, 10,000 shares of UPS on us. And I would try and manage that through calls and puts and, manage. Single stock issues are a real, I'm good at it, but it's a real pain in the ass. I mean, it's a, when somebody has, $2 million, $1,999,000 is in one stock. You need to protect the stuff, but then usually it's a dividend stock. The puts are high, the calls are, that's why people ask me to do it. They don't want to do it, right? But no, you,
right. I mean,
but the procedure is just what you're talking about. Now, does somebody have the conversation and say, well, I was all in a high growth mutual fund at XYZ Corp, but really I don't want to be in that, aggressive of a thing. Fortunately, your T-bill rates are up a little bit, so we could actually make the statement, why don't we put 40% of it in T-bills and see where this all, we are still going to be making 4.5%, 5%, not quite 5%. We were making over 5% for a while. It's not like 3 years ago when you're making 1%, so at least it is
right.
Somewhat of a, of an alternative, wait and see investment. But, it's weird, Larissa, and kind of keep your eye open for this. Sometimes people don't understand the change they went through. And I had a conversation with somebody a few weeks ago, and I'm not so sure I ever wanted the guy's account because he's a little out there. But he said, my account's sort of the same. I haven't talked to you in like 5 years, which I hadn't. And he says, I got all the same stuff. And I said, well, to me, that's a problem. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, the last time I talked to you, you were working. Now you're not. And you're in the same, high risk stuff that had been winners for you. So I congratulate you on having them. But now you're not working. Your risk profile is different. He looked at me like I had three heads.
Sure.
So I think maybe what you're from the planner side, the fact that somebody reaches out to you and is willing to pay you, maybe that means they're more willing to listen. I don't know.
You would hope that they're more willing to listen.
Yeah. And it's not about stock picking or telling people what you can do or not do. It's having an assessment of where they are. If you were to say, open up an account and say, my three-year-old that likes his own French fry package, I'm going to put $300 a month in his account. You know what? What are we going to do? We're just going to buy something, right? We're not going to hedge him.
No.
If you're 25 and you just get married and you and the wife are finally putting some money in, putting some money out, we're probably not going to hedge that. I mean, why would we? I mean, but all of a sudden you're, you got $2 million in one stock and you're 80 and you're never going to work a day in your life. Well, there's a whole different problem there, right?
Right. And that's where I'd be curious with those 401ks, how are people starting to transition out? And again, getting back to the idea of who needs a CFP, we have this idea that CFPs are reserved for what you're doing, these are reserved for people who have a couple million dollars. But really, it should be reserved for almost everybody.
Without a doubt.
Because there's going to be that transition, and we don't have education really surrounding that tradition or that transition for retirees. There's nobody out there saying, hey, this is what you need to do for your life so you can be set up in retirement, so you know where the money is coming from, so you know that you can be covered, and that when you have, I listened in on your last call, when you have that $350, drug that you have to take,
yeah,
you can cover that cost, because that's a real problem for retirees.
Well, without a doubt. Hey, you wouldn't mind if we invited you back, would you?
I would love it.
I think it's spectacular, because you're coming at the problems, the same problems, in a little different direction. I find it amazingly educational.
Oh, great. Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing this. This is a lot of fun. And I'm very much looking forward to discussing the inflation of the price of education.
Without a doubt. Hey, you know what? Maybe you can get into it, because I can't. When I did a study in 2020, there's a site. I think it might be from the colleges, and I got in there. It is absolutely spectacular. Every college, I don't know if so many frigging colleges there are. Every college for the last, at least since 2000, tuition going all the way back then, in-state, out-of-state, room and board, and now I can't get in there. I think you got to pay, or whoever it was decided to make it a... I'll bet you can get in.
If
you can find it, it's absolutely fascinating. I just have one question about our friend Russell. Back to school, do you think he's getting a new crop of cardigans?
He could be. I wouldn't put it past him.
Because I think he's probably worn the elbows out on some of the old ones.
I think he has. And it's got to look good for the students.
Without a doubt. You take care of yourself, and we'll get you back sooner rather than later, maybe even on with Russell, because the both of you are terrific. I mean, but I have no, I'm just as comfortable one or the other, because you guys are whatever. We'll do something and enjoy yourself down there. And I think the Irish are playing Purdue. Are they there or in South Bend? I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't speculate anything that's happening at Notre Dame.
Well, I think they're playing Purdue for the first time in about 5 years this year.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll talk about that. Maybe, who knows, maybe we might get together on that. S&P Futures up 18, NASDAQ Futures up 87. Andrew, nice job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Thank you.
That's all, folks.